Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg. Today, we're joined by British biologist and historian of science, Matthew Cobb, author of the new biography, Crick, A Mind in Motion. Now, Francis Crick is, of course, forever linked to the double helix, a discovery that rewired biology in the 20th century. But Cobb's book argues that DNA was only the opening act. Crick went on to help launch molecular biology, push the central dogma, and later dive headfirst into neuroscience and the mystery of consciousness.
What makes this story pop is the person at the center of it. Not a quiet, cloistered genius, but a restless, collaborative, sometimes abrasive, and often hilarious thinker. A man whose mind didn't sit still and whose scientific life was powered by conversation, argument, and the sheer joy of chasing fundamental truths. Matthew Cobb is here to take us inside Crick's moving mind from DNA to the brain. And into what it really means to think like a scientist. Matthew Cobb, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
It's great to be back here, Lynn and Scott. Good to see you and hear you.
Yes, well, a mind in motion. It's rare to find a scientist who not only wins a Nobel Prize for discovering the double helix, but also becomes deeply fascinated by consciousness and experiences like peyote. We don't know he experienced that, but certainly was interested.
I know that he smoked cannabis a lot and he experimented with LSD. He may have tried peyote, but this was the starting point. I wanted to understand, this mind, how he'd been able to do these amazing things. And I came across these letters and correspondence with a beat poet, Michael McClure, and I discovered that Crick had in 1959 bought a copy of one of McClure's early poems called Peyote Poem, which describes the psychedelic and emetic, because peyote makes you throw up, effects of chewing peyote. And it's this huge long, Crick kept it for the rest of his life. He pinned it up at wall in home at home and then kept it. And it's very, very striking. And Crick was struck. He didn't know what peyote was. He was very naive at that point, but he's very struck by this kind of ecstatic description of insight, which in McClure's case was produced by the peyote, but in Crick's case was, at least initially, produced by scientific discovery.
It must have been fascinating to research as you went along uncovering these things. And this is kind of what you do as a biographer and do quite well. I wanted to ask you just to take us back through our biology class. We know the double helix is that twisted ladder-like structure that James Watson and Francis Crick, along with many others who they collaborated with, came up with. Before we knew about the double helix and DNA, what didn't we know about genetics?
Well, we knew that there were things called genes, which were probably a physical structure, but at least for part of the 20th century, people thought maybe it was the amount of something. But really, by the middle of the century, what people thought was that on chromosomes, which are these little thread-like structures we have in all our cells, that genes are located on there. And this has been discovered at the early years of the century by work on the tiny fruit fly, Drosophila. So we knew that genes did things. They enabled the cell to produce proteins. And what the gene itself was made of was a mystery. So there were some people from the middle of the 1940s who found evidence that in one strain of bacteria that there was something. DNA acted a bit like a gene. But lots of people said, well, that doesn't matter because bacteria don't have genes. They're completely different. And there wasn't any really very good evidence. Most people thought that genes were made of a mixture of proteins, which can be amazingly complicated, and DNA, which is chemically really boring. It's just composed of a handful of components. And so what they imagined was that on the chromosome, the structure of the chromosome was made of DNA. It was like scaffolding. And then on it were these genes that were made of proteins that were kind of like a negative, like a mold, like a jelly mold. You pour jelly into a mold and you get a shape. So that's what each gene, which could produce a particular protein, proteins can be all sorts of shapes and sizes. Then you had kind of like the negative on the DNA molecule, which was thought to be the kind of superstructure. So really, people didn't really know much, I mean, about the molecular basis of genetics. They knew how it worked, but what was it was actually made of, they didn't know. And, you know, listeners got to remember or even realize that we didn't know that DNA was the genetic material in multicellular organisms until the middle of the 1970s. It wasn't shown. It was a very strong working hypothesis, but it wasn't demonstrated. So in a way, it was the discovery of the double helix where you can immediately see how this molecule can do two things. It can copy itself because each strand is the negative of the other strand. And if you know one strand, you can make the other one. So if you can unravel it, then the cell can make two identical copies. And we know this is what chromosomes do. They duplicate and copy themselves. And secondly, that the order of the bases, these half rungs that connect the two parts of the ladder, they could come in any order. So basically, you've got an infinite information source. So once they discovered the double helix, then everybody started to take the molecular basis of heredity much more seriously. And most people thought that it was DNA.
So Crick is often thought of in the scientific community as the DNA guy, right? That's what we're talking about. But how did you decide how much narrative to weigh to give the double helix versus his latter work in molecular biology and neuroscience?
Well, yes. One of the reasons why I wanted to write the book is that I wrote a book in 2015 called Life's Greatest Secret, which was about what happened after the discovery of the double helix and how we worked out in about 10, 15 years, the genetic code. And Crick was at the center of that. And my book, without it intending to be, turned into this great paean of praise because he was so clever in working out the implications of the double helix. Then I wrote the book that I came onto your show for about 5 years ago called The Idea of the Brain, where to my great surprise, in the half of the book, which is about modern neuroscience, he kept on muscling his way to the fore. And that was not my impression. I mean, I'd been around in the 70s. I was a very young scientist, neuroscientist, and I hadn't realized quite what an extraordinary influence he had. So my challenge was to tell the story of the double helix, which is, been told a million times, but I wanted to tell it right, or much more right than it's been told in the past. Then show how he alone was able to think about the consequences of that structure, and then really make clear to readers that he had this second career, which was remarkably influential and really shaped modern neuroscience in many ways.
Well, a big thread in your book is Crick's collaborative style, his reliance on intense argument and dialogue. How did you trace those collaborations onto the page without turning the story into a list of co-authors?
Well, I'm glad it's not that. Well, I tried to show the reader. I mean, it struck me. I was thinking about how he worked. This was actually the origin of this whole book, was a project that I had in the 2017, 2016 about Crick and his colleague, Sydney Brenner. Sydney Brenner was a South African researcher and they shared an office for 20 years. And they were renowned for having these intense arguments every day, talking about anything, most of which was rubbish. But then every now and again, they'd come up with a brilliant idea. And I thought that was really interesting. And I went to Singapore, where Sydney was kind of stuck because he was very ill and he couldn't fly, and talked to him there and made a BBC radio program about Brenner's life and work. And then I realized that Brenner was not an exception. It wasn't just Watson, who everybody knows, who he had a fairly short life with, interaction with. But there are other people really important. And basically, he's kind of a serial non-monogamist in scientific terms. So he has one partner and then he shifts area of research. He shifts area, individual with whom he interacts. And I was very struck that most of these people, were all men. They were all younger than him. And many of them were not British. So they had something else. So he needs someone else to argue with, to have this very intense combative style of thinking. And, I realized that if he'd just had another him, that would have been useless, right? It would have had the same kind of approach. He wanted somebody who could say something different, who could challenge him. And there were women as well, large number of women in molecular biology and in neuroscience, with whom he worked and had nearly as intense relationships.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with biologist and historian of science, Matthew Cobb. He has written a new book about Francis Crick. It's a biography. It's called Crick, A Mind in Motion. Okay, since you mentioned collaboration with women, we've got to go back just to set the record straight because I had read before and again with your book about this controversy surrounding the discovery of the double helix. And as a woman myself, I'm sensitive to the fact that so many women in science were never recognized for their great contributions. And one of those is Rosalind Franklin, who did collaborate with Watson and Crick. And many say that they sort of took her, her science, and then she didn't share in the Nobel Prize. Of course, she had died by that time. But take us through that because you dispute that.
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't my intention. I didn't start out when I started writing the book. I had no intention of whitewashing Crick or finding anything. I didn't expect to find anything new. I mean, this has been dug over many, many times. However, together with Nathaniel Comfort, who's just finishing a biography of Jim Watson, we made a trip to almost kind of pilgrimage to Franklin's archives in Cambridge, in England, just to look at the papers. The papers are all online, but you get a bit fetishistic about wanting to touch the paper and actually see it. And that led us to realize that the way that the, partly through an unpublished article, so that famous picture of Watson and Crick with the DNA model that everybody's seen, that's on the front cover of the UK edition of my book, that photo was taken to accompany an article which was supposed to appear in Time Life magazine. And we came across the original article that was spiked. It was never printed. And in that article, which was worked on with Franklin, the woman journalist had portrayed it very much as a joint effort, that there were two teams, one in Cambridge, one in King's College London, and it presented it in a very, very different way. At the same time, I discovered the first public presentation of the double helix, which was in London at the Royal Society, at a kind of science fair, which they still have, which they called a conversazione, which all the scientists would present their latest data. And there was a presentation of the double helix, and it was, kind of the poster thing or the presentation they made was co-authored by all of the researchers who were involved, the seven researchers who'd been involved in the discovery, in collecting the data: Maurice Wilkins, Rosalind Franklin, their colleagues, and Watson and Crick. And the first author on that was Rosalind Franklin. So again, this was not at all a ha-ha, we won, you lost, which is kind of the vision you get from Jim Watson's the double helix. It was not at all that way. Finally, myself and Nathaniel, we discovered this little note from one of Franklin's colleagues, who was also a friend of Crick's, saying that Franklin was going to give a talk on structure of DNA, but that he probably wasn't going to have much detail in it, and that he should ask a colleague of his boss, in fact, Max Perutz, if he wanted to know more about it. So Franklin, this is shortly before Watson and Crick make the discovery, she's almost kind of inviting him, because he had an informal report of the whole work of the people at King's, not just of Franklin, but of Wilkins and of everybody else, almost kind of inviting him to, well, take a look if you want to know any more about what I'm doing. So there wasn't at all this proprietorial. DNA was not a big deal when they discovered it, right? That's one of the things you've got to remember. The first press coverage was about 6 weeks later. Because, as I said, DNA was not the genetic material. It had not been demonstrated. This gradually became more apparent. And Franklin, after her death in 1958 from ovarian cancer, I mean, she was not forgotten, right? She had obituaries in the New York Times, in the London Times, and in Nature. She was a big deal, not because of DNA primarily, but because of her subsequent work on viruses. DNA was a bit of a sideshow for a long, long time.
Okay. Well, thanks for that explanation. Side comment, fetishistic. That's going to be my new word of the day. Did you just make that up? I love it. Well, let's move into the neuroscience. We do want to get there because you are a neuroscientist yourself. Talk about the origins that you learned that Crick was sort of the father of neuroscience, but he hasn't really been credited with that. What is neuroscience? How did he find out
That's a
about
very good question.
it?
I have a degree in psychology, and that was almost before neuroscience was named. So Crick decided to, in 1947, when he's 31, his scientific career has been blown apart by the war. He hasn't got his PhD yet. He abandoned it, in fact, to do various things for the UK government during the war. And then in 1947, he decides he wants to do two things. He wants to understand the nature of life, and he wants to understand the nature of consciousness. And what motivates him in both cases is he wants to remove kind of mystical, non-materialist explanations of both these phenomena. That's his motivation, right? He wants to root life and consciousness in a material basis. He pretty much manages, he decides to start with life. So he starts with understanding the structure of the proteins, and then inadvertently wasn't what he was supposed to be doing, DNA. And then he thinks about the implications of all that. And then he eventually, in the mid-1970s, moves to study neuroscience. What he wants to do is to understand the brain, and he doesn't actually make a great breakthrough. Okay, so I think that's the first thing, is that nobody else has done either. That was the topic of our conversation 5 years ago. We're kind of stuck, and Crick's contribution helped us provide us with the tools. So, for example, he argued very, very strongly for the need for neuroscientists to understand the precise structure of the brain. So now we've got things called connectomes, which are these maps, perhaps down to the cellular level in the case of a small animal, but really detailed maps. He argued that we can use molecular biology to identify what neurons are doing by seeing what genes are expressed in there. He even predicted that we would be able to use light by manipulating the genome. We'd be able to use light to control the activity of neurons and therefore test our hypotheses as to their function in the brain. He wrote that in the end of 1999. Within a few months, he got a letter from somebody saying, "Hey, we've just done this in the lab." And this is called optogenetics, and it's an incredibly important experimental tool. The other thing that I discovered that he did was he was very heavily involved in what is the ancestors of today's AI, with Geoffrey Hinton, who went on to win the Nobel Prize the year before last, working in something called the Parallel Distributed Programming Group, which was based in San Diego, where he was at the Salk Institute. And this was a group of neuroscientists, of cognitive scientists, of computer scientists, and Crick was in there arguing with them the need to root their models in biology. He said, "These models you're making are brilliant, they're amazing, but unless they're rooted in biological structures, in the way the brain's organized, this is not going to tell us anything about the brain." And that's pretty much still an argument that's going on inside AI. But above all, what he did was to make the study of consciousness respectable. So when I was a student in the mid-1970s, consciousness, a psychology student, we sat around, we said, "Well, yeah, it's some kind of epiphenomenon of the brain. And you can't study it, so forget about it." Crick had rather more was rather more determined than we were, and he said, "Well, we must be able to." And he came up with a whole set of, over the next 20 years, of approaches to try and root the study of consciousness in a material activity. Now, that's why you go to an airport bookstore, and there's just loads of books about consciousness and what it means and all the rest of it. Crick was really at the forefront of that, and he produced a huge bestseller in the early 1990s called The Astonishing Hypothesis, which basically was just saying, look, consciousness is a material phenomenon. But that had an immense influence on the field and also inspired many young researchers to join neuroscience. So, though he's not kind of creating a whole new field, he's pushing it because of his reputation. He's pushing it, and he's listened to, and he's pushing it in a certain direction, which we're still continuing at the moment.
You talk about his hypothesizing. Crick, he was famous for bold theorizing, sometimes even ahead of getting the data. In your view, when was that audacity really productive, and when do you think it kind of led him maybe astray?
Well, it certainly led him astray at one point in the middle of the early 1970s when he got very, very excited about the structure of chromosomes and he thought he'd re discovered something very, very important. Around the same time, he also decided that maybe the origin of life was in microbes that had been sent by aliens to Earth as a kind of way of spreading their seed around the universe. And in both these ideas, he was remarkably wrong. I mean, the point about Crick's hypothesizing was that he did not hold on to the ideas, that the ideas were there to be tested experimentally. And it was kind of like a challenge to experimentalists. And he was not an experimentalist. He was rubbish in the laboratory. He would think of an idea that would explain a set of data that he'd read about. And then he would basically, one, try and find problems with his idea. And if he couldn't, then he would, publish it and encourage researchers to try and investigate it. And as I say, in the case of those two things that he came up with in early 1971 about chromosome structure and we're all from aliens. They were both completely, completely wacky and completely wrong. And as it happened, for various other reasons, he actually had quite a he had a nervous breakdown at that stage as well, and was very much kind of exhausted by this complete mania that he hit upon in early 1971. So he didn't always, he was mainly wrong. I mean, but that's what scientists are, right? Most of the time we're wrong. It's not very often you're completely right. And he didn't mind that. That was fine. He was very happy to be wrong.
Oh, that is fascinating that the whole alien genetic model here. I'm glad he didn't ever find that data.
Well, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the data went completely in the opposite direction and have shown that life, it is possible because we don't know how chemistry turned into biochemistry, into life somewhere deep in the sea. And maybe he's right. There is a very, very, very slight possibility, but his hypothesis is not taken seriously these days. Let's put it that way.
Well, if Crick were actually alive today and walking into a modern biology or neuroscience lab, what questions do you think would really grab his attention? And what do you think he'd make of the current scientific culture?
Well, I think, well, firstly, he would, if he were to be a younger person, he would not last a year in today's academia, right? He was not the kind of person, a bit like Higgs, who won the Nobel Prize for the Higgs boson and published about two papers in 50 years. Crick published a great deal, but he didn't get big grants. He would not succeed. I mean, he was a researcher. He didn't teach. He had no teaching responsibilities at all during his career. However, what would he be excited about? I think firstly he'd probably be a bit disappointed in that the studies of consciousness since he died in 2004 have kind of lost their way. He and his colleague Christof Koch set out a series of very clear questions that they wanted us answering about the what they call the neuronal correlates of consciousness. That is the activity of neurons which were correlated with, say, seeing a picture of a giraffe, and these neurons would fire in particular circumstances. And they asked very clear questions about the nature of those neurons, what their activity might be, and so on. The studies of consciousness have now kind of got dispersed. Somebody recently published a paper saying that I think there's something like 250 different theories of consciousness. So that shows that we've no idea what we're doing, right? If people vary so much on their approach, then clearly there's a major problem. So I think he'd be disappointed about that. I hope that he'd be excited by the possibilities we have for through those techniques that he advocated, these connectomes and this genetic manipulation of being able to discover in smaller non-human animals, and indeed not in even in primates, so not in monkeys or apes, the basis, the molecular, the neuronal basis of behavior and of perception. Now, he might not like that because he was really interested in consciousness. And my professional, since that time in the 1970s, my professional approach has been not to try and approach consciousness because I think it's a really hard problem to deal with. But I think that he would be excited by the possibilities there are for very, very precise studies of linking structure of the brain with particular functions. And this link between structure and function is something that went through both his molecular work and then his neuroscience work.
We've been speaking with Matthew Cobb, author of the new biography, Crick, A Mind in Motion. Fascinating insight into one of the fathers of modern DNA. Thank you so much, Matthew, for joining us today on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks a lot, Scott. It's been great. I hope people listen to it or read, listen to the book or read it or borrow it from a library and find it exciting.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. You can find this episode, as well as past episodes, on the KPCW website or on the new KPCW app.
Or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio. And if you liked today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.
If you have a suggestion for a guest or topic for a future episode, email us at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.